joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The White House says it will rethink a range of issues with Israel because of questions about Prime Minister Netanyahu's commitment to a two-state solution. The extremist group ISIS claims responsibility for the killing of foreign tourists at a museum in Tunisia, and Japanese police investigate death threats against U.S. Ambassador Caroline Kennedy. Joining me for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, David Sanger of The New York Times, Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya, and Shane Harris of The Daily Beast. And throughout the hour, you are welcome to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Happy snowy first day of spring, everybody.
Happy spring.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like
Doesn't
it, but
feel like
we'll
it
take your word for it. Like it.
David Sanger, Prime Minister Netanyahu won a fourth term significantly. He told NPR's Steve Inskeep today that he, Netanyahu, did not backtrack on his position on a two-state solution when he made the statement the other day. Is that disingenuous?
Well, it may be disingenuous. I don't think it was surprising. Almost nobody believes that Prime Minister Netanyahu, when he uttered the words of a two-state solution when he first came in this round in 2009, actually believed it. I mean, he had been extremely reluctant, even in talking to other Israeli politicians, to express any enthusiasm for the two-state solution. And in the end, did so only because the United States, President Bush, had repeatedly declared that there had to be two states side by side. President Obama had taken that position. And it was the basis, his agreement to it, was the basis for the United States holding off on these UN resolutions, which we'll sure we'll come back to, that would have declared that there should be a two-state solution, which would essentially be, you know, a major step in the direction of granting Palestinian statehood. But what you saw happen during the campaign, Diane, was that Prime Minister Netanyahu moved back to his right-wing base on all the major issues. He came here to denounce the prospective Iranian nuclear deal. He defended the settlements issue. He backed off on the two-state solution. He sort of went back to core Netanyahu. And wouldn't you have loved to have been the fly on the wall for the congratulatory phone call that President Obama had to deliver to Prime Minister Netanyahu last night, which was described to by the White House in the most terse terms, along with this discussion about reassessing the relationship?
And Nadia, in interviews with U.S. media, Netanyahu also defended the comments he made before the election, suggesting that Arab Israelis were going to flood the polls. Did those comments help him win?
It was a certain extent. What's really interesting about this election, that neither the two-state solution, the Palestinian question, or the concept of have 20% of Israel populations are Arabs, were a major issue in the election. People were caring very much about housing, living conditions, etc. And all of a sudden, when he realized that he was behind in the polls, so he resorted to this fear-mongering. And funny enough, it worked, because as David said, he appeals to his right-wing base, which most of the Likud supporters are Sephardi Jews who comes from Arab countries, funny enough. They have less of an education standard than the Ashkenaz in general. And basically he said to them, well, look, these Arabs have been bused to support this naive leftist Zionist Union, and you have to show up, you have to vote for us. And it's a racist comment that outraged the White House, and it really touched a raw nerve here, because can you imagine if a Republican or a Democrat then in the United States, because he wanted to be elected, said, look at these blacks are being bussed or Latinos being bussed, and this is his own citizens. And when he comes to the United States and he boasts about Israel democracy and how the Arabs are part of it and they're voting, and one of the major issues that the United States are in is this strategic alliance with the state of Israel is over values and the concept of democracy. And here the prime minister using a racist language to win the election.
And House Speaker John Boehner was one of the first here in the United States to congratulate Netanyahu, and he has now said he will make a trip to Jerusalem.
Right. Netanyahu, of course, was here and gave that speech to the U.S. Congress and sort of unofficially declared himself aligned with the Republican Party in the United States. Did not necessarily get the bump maybe that he thought he would have gotten from that speech. And it was important to remember that after that speech is when the polls seemed to start to be turning. And this is when Netanyahu, heading into what was supposed to be, I think, by most accounts, a fairly easy victory, looked like he was actually facing a real challenge from the left, and then made these statements that we've been talking about.
So what do you think it means when the White House says we are going to reassess our relationship with Israel?
Well, one of the first things that we're already seeing whispered and talked about is whether or not the United States might hold back from opposing certain resolutions presented to the UN Security Council that would be more favorable to the Palestinians. I don't know that you're going to see an embrace full-fledged of Palestinian statehood. That would be quite extreme. But there's already been talk right now of a UN Security resolution that would call for restarting the peace process, which would be a real change from the way this has normally worked, where the UN has essentially stayed out of that, and the United States has pushed for the two parties to come together on their own to negotiate. If the U.S. was now to step back and not veto that resolution as it came, and the U.N. were calling for that process to start, that would be a very clear signal to the Israelis that we have changed our position with them diplomatically.
How likely, David?
I think it would be a very difficult thing for President Obama to go do. And I think the opposition would run pretty high. I think you'd first have to see how the Iranian negotiations worked out, because I think that would affect it a lot. And if it put President Obama in a difficult spot, imagine what a difficult spot this would create for Hillary Clinton, because she would be caught between an outrage at what Prime Minister Netanyahu has done, which I'm sure she shares, because he gave her as much grief as he gave President Obama. But at the same time, she's got to worry about alienating a very active, critical to fundraising constituency that's very supportive of Prime Minister Netanyahu no matter what he does.
Although I will say that most of the Jewish voters, as you know, in the United States are Democrats. So the fact that Netanyahu has been aligning himself, as Shane said, with the Republicans is a different story. But you're absolutely right. I think it's unprecedented that a United States president will veto, or will not use the veto, rather, at the UN Security Council, because ever since the establishment of the Jewish state, Republicans and Democratic presidents has shielded Israel from any Security Council resolution that will be seen as anti-Israel. But the White House can use it as a pressure card. It will be the card that you will play to tell Netanyahu, look, if you don't come to this peace process, because if it's the only way we believe, and this is, by the way, why the United States wanted always to protect Israel in the international venue, including the UN, because they believe the only way to establish a Palestinian state is through negotiation. But they condemn unilateral action, whether on the Palestinians or the Israelis.
But going back to David Sanger's point, Shane Harris, negotiations over a nuclear deal in Iran do continue, and they are vital to this whole relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously Netanyahu made no pretense about how he feels about the way that those negotiations are going right now. And that does seem to be, from the Obama administration's point of view, the more important and immediate foreign policy challenge here that it wants to succeed. I mean, the relationship between Obama and Netanyahu is famously terrible. The peace process died last summer. Both sides fundamentally don't trust each other. Obviously, the Iranian deal is much more important for the White House right now. And I think the degree to which they're willing trying to just, you know, volubly signal their displeasure and disgust with Netanyahu just is a reflection of just how toxic the relationship already has been for a long time.
What might the deal look like?
Well, we're beginning to get some sense of not only the outlines of the deal, but what the continuing differences are. Secretary of State Kerry has been in Lausanne in Switzerland almost all week, meeting with his Iranian counterparts. That alone is a little bit strange because he has so invested himself personally in this set of negotiations. And it's not as if you can bring the President of the United States in as the closer here. You know, the usual would be allow the negotiators to do their thing and have the Secretary of State come in as the closer. They churned away with very little progress this week. And, of course, we're headed toward a deadline of the end of the month. They're supposed to get back together next week in Switzerland. I'm going to leave early next week to go see the end of this. The critical issue at this point is the Iranians don't want the sanctions to drag on. They want them lifted right away. And they also want to be able to do research and development on the most advanced centrifuges as quickly as possible.
David Sanger, New York Times. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org. And from the Roth Family Foundation, investing in organizations that inspire hope, dignity, and creativity. Working to connect communities to the services, opportunities, and tools for self-empowerment and self-expression. Learn more at RothFamilyFoundation.org.
Welcome back to the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya, Shane Harris of The Daily Beast, and David Sanger of The New York Times. Here's a few emails like this one. For the first time in history, Israel's native Arabs consolidated themselves into a single electoral ticket, the Joint List, and in so doing garnered the third largest block of seats in the Knesset, bested only by the right-leaning Likud and the left-leaning Zionist Union. Yet no one is mentioning the Joint List as a potential coalition partner. Are Israel's Arabs politically toxic? Will they ever truly be accepted into the larger body politic? And if not, where might this lead in the end, Shane?
Well, you know, the Arabs traditionally don't have a history of joining in coalitions with Israeli parties, in part because I don't think they want to be seen as endorsing policies that they fundamentally may disagree with. But those messages are pointing out something that's different here. This group, the Arab List, did garner, you know, the third highest number of seats. It could become a force to be reckoned with as a bloc if it were to choose to make an alliance and do something that they traditionally have not done. So, I mean, I think it shows that as a political force, they can't simply simply be ignored and actually may have a lot more potential power and influence than they have traditionally exercised.
Also, remember that they were sort of forced into putting together this list. The law changed since the last election. The Arab parties knew that they would be wiped out if they couldn't get at least four seats. So they managed to seal up their differences and join together. Some people believe the legal change was actually intended to wipe them out politically. Instead, what's happened is they've unified and come back.
All right. Let's move to what's happening in Tunisia. Nadia, ISIS is claiming responsibility for the attack on foreign tourists at a Tunisian museum. Are there reasons to doubt that group's involvement?
Yes, because there was a video that they put on in December, I think, through the social media saying that they're going to attack this coalition of secularist and Islamist new government. Tunisia is considered a success story in the Arab Spring, and they obviously don't like this alliance. They don't like any government that does not agree with them. So they make that threat. Now, is it them? We really don't know. Today they said, the Tunisian government said that two of the attackers, one of them was known to the security service, was trained in Libya, actually. He could have been aligned with ISIS. He could be Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, which is active in that part of the world. But everybody claims it. There is no evidence to link them as such. But whether it's them, or if it's them that it shows for the first time that they're extending beyond the traditional place for them, which is Syria and Iraq, because they've consolidated their power on setting up what they call the Islamic State, while they leave in the external kind of attack on soft targets like tourists, for example, in Tunisia to Al-Qaeda, like we have seen also. This is the worst attack we have seen since the attack on Luxor in Egypt, right, when 56 tourists were killed. It's easy to attack them. Some people say it might be in retaliation to the crackdown on 30 militants that the government arrested, or also some weapons have been seized to them. But you might need a week to organize this attack, or it could happen on a day before, because it's very easy to see tourists from a cruise ship going to a famous museum and two guys who want to die with explosives and just go and attack. And they were lucky that they had 20 people dead,
and
22
David,
in general.
How might this affect Tunisia's own transition to democracy?
Well, it starts by affecting the economy. And I thought what was interesting, it was right after the attack, you saw a release by some of these militants of exactly what the economic impact they thought would be, which tells you they're going right for the tourism. A number of cruise ships which normally stop in Tunisia canceled those stops right away. And, of course, remember, Tunisia was the only success story that we sort of had coming out of what we once called the Arab Spring. And so the concern here is that it creates an economic crisis in a country that was actually, of all the Arab states, was probably doing about the best of anybody you could imagine. And I suspect that that's what made them such a big target.
You know, I see in this strains, too, of the Charlie Hebdo attack, where we had these two individuals who said we're doing this on the behest of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But in the days that came after, there was no definitive link showing that AQAP had directed that attack. And what you were left with was this conclusion that these ideologies are powerful enough to inspire people to act on their own. And think about the strength of an ideology like that for a moment that would, you know, inspire these people to undertake an attack like this, clearly directed it towards, go right to the soft underbelly of a growing but fragile economy. I think this is probably, for intelligence officials, what is so befuddling, is that when you cannot make those complete direct links to know exactly when the operation is going to be directed, you're merely left to sit back and wait for somebody to decide to act on their own. And for years, that's been the big fear, that this would become the new strain of terror attacks.
But that economic factor is really important with those cruise ships canceling out.
It is. And, you know, once the cruise ships cancel out, then, of course, anybody who's got air reservations
right.
is thinking, am I going to go in if the cruise ships think it's too dangerous to land there? And, you know, I think Nadia had it just right when she said, you know, it's hard to hide a cruise ship pulling into town. So it's very possible that this was a very well-planned attack. It's also very possible that they saw it coming in and they just saw a target of opportunity.
Just to add something else, which is, you know, Tunisia is a success story for all the reasons we mentioned, but also it has a bigger middle class and a higher educated population than the rest of the Arab world. It's a very liberal kind of country, and it has tradition of laws that protect women and family rights, etc. But also it has the largest number of foreign fighters from Arab countries to join ISIS, 3,000, which is really interesting because it also pinpoints to the unemployment among the youth, the marginalization of people who live in the suburb, which explains somehow why these people has a larger number to go to Iraq and Syria.
All right. Lots of emails and anger directed toward Netanyahu. Here's one from Mike, who says Netanyahu is not backtracking on the two-state issue. Either he really is as intransigent as he claimed before the election, or he was simply lying in order to drive up turnout among the right wing and save his own skin. And Mike completes his email by saying, seems fairly clear the latter is true. Shane?
Yeah, I think if the election had been held a week earlier, you could imagine that Netanyahu might have not have suddenly had this apparent conversion to being against the two-state solution because he wasn't facing the threat from the left, or at least he wasn't perceived to be. Maybe the polls were wrong. But, you know, if you go back and you look at that's the earlier speech, but then you look at it years ago where he expressed support for this, but then you look at the action subsequent to that, I don't think anyone really believed that he was in favor of the two-state solution. And in fact, when he gave that interview in the days before, a lot of the initial analysis and reaction you said was, well, finally he's being honest and telling us what we already knew and already suspected.
I think that's right. We've seen the true Netanyahu out of this entire campaign experience. And I think some of the anger that you're seeing in the emails that you're getting and the calls coming in, Diane, comes in part from his effort to whip up the vote by coming out the day before and saying the Arabs are voting. Well, the Arabs who are voting are Arabs who are Israeli citizens and have a right to vote. And this gets right at that the other existential fear that exists in Israel today. If the first is Iran with a bomb, the second is, I think you'd have to say, the demographic bomb for Israel, which is that the Arab population is growing. I think that Netanyahu recognizes, not within his political time in office, but in the next generation, they're going to have to choose between having an openly democratic country and election and having a Jewish state. And that's the one of the arguments in favor of a two-state solution to many people, that if, in fact, you have a two-state solution, it relieves this democratic and demographic dilemma that the Israelis face.
But also the Israeli society has shifted to the right a lot. Netanyahu can say whatever he wants. But the interesting point is the electorate has listened to him and heeded his advice and voted to prevent, as he said, the Arabs who come in there. So that's one thing. The second thing is we focus on Netanyahu as the guy who doesn't really believe in a two-state solution and his force because he's a masterful tactician and politician, etc. But also, if you look at his coalition, if you look at the two other people who are going to be in his coalition, which is Lieberman, and you have Naftali Bennett. Both of them, Naftali Bennett openly believed that there is no Palestinian state, there is no West Bank. He basically believed that you should annex the West Bank. And this is a guy who's in his cabinet, was, and most likely will be in the next government. While Lieberman himself, who was a foreign minister, believed in the transfer of the Palestinians. He said there is no such thing as a Palestinian state. It's Jordan. They should go there. And the Israelis, when they're convenient for them, they say, oh, the Palestinian Authority are joining hands with this terrorist, Hamas, who advocate for the destruction of Israel, while they have their own government and extreme right-wingers who believe in the transfer and annexing the West Bank, which is killing the idea of two-state solution.
Nadia is right to focus on these people that are going to be part of the coalition, and there's one more to keep our eye on, too, who is Moshe Kalon, who runs the Kulanu Party. Moshe Kalon was a minister in Likud. He split with Netanyahu, but is really more of a center-right party that was focusing mostly on economic issues,
right,
which is important to remember. Those were actually the big debates and issues that were driving the Israeli election, not so much national security. It was the exorbitant cost of housing. It was the price of groceries. It was income disparity. In the end, national security issues end up picking the prime minister. But the real power broker now is going to be Cologne. And that really comes back to, I think, these socioeconomic issues that were really at the heart of the election. He's going to be one to watch, I think.
All right. Let's talk about President Putin. He kind of
a good story.
Disappeared.
He's back, is.
He disappeared for a while. My own theory about where he was gone and why he was gone was that he hoped to deflect the attention from the killing of Boris Nemtsov. Others are saying what?
Well, your theory is as good as any other I've heard this week, and probably a little better, Diane. He disappeared. He then, when he reappeared during a meeting with another foreign leader, he made fun of all of the conspiracy theories that had popped up, which ranged from he was sick, to he had an awful flu, to he was dead, to he was secretly in Switzerland with his girlfriend, to he was secretly in Ukraine. I mean, you got every possible conspiracy theory. And what was amusing about it was that it sort of brought you back to that era of the conspiracy theories about Soviet leaders, about whom there would be these elaborate theories and rumors when they disappeared. And every once in a while, it turned out they were dead or sick, so which
but
only made it better, right?
Round two, he had had a stroke, or he had gone to Switzerland for the birth of
his love child.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
And there are other children that he has fathered? Do we know that, or is that just rumor?
I track their nuclear program better than I track his progeny.
Probably a good idea, yeah. David Sanger, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But the point is that when he came back, he just shrugged it off.
Yeah, he shrugged it off, and there was a great, you know, people were asking questions about this in Russia. I mean, we're talking about it here, and it's almost viewed through a comic lens, and to some degree it was there as well. The blogosphere was alight with all of this. Now, his spokesman came out and dismissed these rumors when he was gone. They actually aired footage that had been made to look like he was meeting with people at the time, but actually they were meetings that had happened many days earlier.
Did they change the date on it? Another old Soviet trick.
Right, a very old Soviet trick. Actually, total deflection here. I mean, what I found fascinating about this, though, is that in the West, we're sort of looking at this and we're laughing at it, and it sort of underscores the degree to which maybe we think that this is kind of a throwback to the Soviet era. But, at the same time, imagine if suddenly the president of Russia is gone. We don't know who replaces him. This is an extremely brittle, fragile system. I think underneath all of this are some deep anxieties about who is actually running Russia. How is it that the president of this country can just disappear for 10 days? Can you imagine what would happen if Barack Obama disappeared for an hour?
Well, remember what happened when that congressman disappeared to go off to
the Appalachian Trail.
That's, what's his name from South Carolina?
Yeah, the
Appalachian
Trail.
Right,
that's where Putin
had gone to Argentina.
But it's true. I mean, this is why we have the pool system at the White House, where you track every movement of the president, so he cannot really disappear. But Putin proves to be, he is Russia, and Russia is Putin. Mm. For the whole week, the whole media, they are just stuck. They don't know
and
what to
totally
do because he's not there.
Completely.
If I can take issue with one, you can, as president of the United States, disappear for a few hours. And nobody took greater joy in this than President Bush
went after 9/11. Yeah.
Right. And I was White House correspondent during much of the Bush presidency for the Times. And the events that he enjoyed the most were getting into a car, a normal car, at the
Skip
ranch, having a baseball cap down over his eyes. He was in the car, I think, with Condoleezza Rice. And they drove out and secretly ended up getting on a plane and flying to Iraq. And, you'd wake up in the morning and you'd discover the president was in Iraq. And they did bring a very small pool. They'd usually tip in one or two reporters. But so it's possible to go do, but 10 days, that would be a real challenge. Yeah. Yeah.
And to come back with no explanation and just not to
or
tell
no
people.
Need to have an explanation.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's like I rule
so
the country.
What happens to the investigation in Nemtsov's murder? Has it sort of? I know one man has been arrested, but he claims he was tortured.
Yeah, they tried to initially blame this on Chechen separatists, which just sounded absurd. I mean, you go back and you watch the surveillance tape of this, and it looks like something, again, out of a KGB playbook.
But this guy was a close friend.
Right. Well, you know what? I don't think anybody can take the investigation into this seriously at all. And, I mean, this is why I sort of like your theory that he's deflecting attention from one thing by creating another spectacle. But I don't think we can have any.
That.
Yeah, sure.
I'll take credit for that. All right. And... you know, I wanted to go back to you, David Sanger, on just one thing very briefly. Iran has said it will increase its oil production if the sanctions are lifted. And we'd all like to know how realistic that possibility is. We've got to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about that, as well as whatever else you'd like to raise. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. From Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring email marketing software, automation tools to send personalized messages, and built-in analytics on desktop and mobile devices. Learn more at myemma.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org.
On the next Fresh Air, our interview with blues historian and record producer Sam Charters, who died Wednesday. He tracked down Lightnin' Hopkins and helped revive his career.
So I rented a guitar for him, got a bottle of gin, and we made his first LP.
Also, Phil Klei, who won a National Book Critics Circle Award this month for his short story collection, Redeployment. Join us.
And welcome back. Just before the break, I had asked David Sanger to tell us about Iran's offer to increase oil production if sanctions are lifted. How realistic is this, David?
It's not as much increasing production as it must is increasing exports. What they would like to do is get back to where they were before these sanctions went in. Their oil exports are down, and their oil revenue exports is down about 60% from pre-sanction periods. Now, what's happened in the interim is that the Saudis have increased their production. The United States has dramatically increased its production, largely because of shale recovery and so forth. And so if the Iranians actually did end up putting another million barrels a day, it would add to what many view right now is already a glut on the market and drive prices down. Now, they're a long way from that. I mean, this would be a high-class problem to have, because it would only be if they actually reached an agreement by the end of this month that then got finalized in June.
All right. I'm going to open the phones now first to Alex in Indianapolis. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Diane, or good morning, rather. Sorry. Great show. Always love listening.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. So my question has to do with Vladimir Putin. I read on an article recently from CNN that he has invited the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, to Victory Day in Moscow. And on top of that, obviously, has done certain things where he's eliminated 90% of their debts to Russia. What opportunity does that afford him? And outside of just irking the West, what is he really trying to accomplish here?
What do you think, Shane?
Well, that's a good question. Why align yourself with a rogue dictator that is, you know, sort of scoffing at international convention? Well, I guess
from another dictator.
From another dictator. Wait, now maybe that is some affinity there between the two of them. I mean, we were talking during the break how interesting it was that Kim Jong-un's first trip abroad is going to be to Russia and not to China, as it historically would be. What's going on in the mind of Putin is always an interesting game to get, you know, but I would imagine that he would probably rather have more allies to his side, and he has few of them right now. Kim Jong-un certainly has demonstrated his capacity to antagonize the West and the United States in the past several months, also with the Sony attack. So it might be that he sort of finds in him a kind of a fellow traveler, as it were.
All right.
One thing you might say to Vladimir Putin is, good luck. I hope you have better luck managing him than the Chinese have.
All right. To Robert in Miami, Florida. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Ms. Raymond and guests, I'm just kind of confused and a little bit upset or disappointed that it's not more outrageous as relates to Mr. Netanyahu and his attitude. It seems as if he's trying to dictate our foreign policy. He comes to the Congress and gives this speech undercutting the president, and then, you know, we provide security for him at the Iron Dome. Even when there are situations in like this past year with Gaza, when little kids were being bombed on the beaches, the response from the United States was, it's unfortunate, it's tragic. However, Israel has a right to protect itself or defend itself. So I'm saying, I'm trying to figure out how is he an ally to...
How is he an ally? Because it is an alliance between the United States and Israel, no matter who is the prime minister. And despite this tension between President Obama and Netanyahu, the White House still come and say that this is a very important allies. We still provide Israel with the probably the highest number of military aid, the Iron Dome, they shelter them in international venues, in ICC, in the UN, etc. But yes, Netanyahu has been seen as ungrateful that he comes with this pompous idea of dictating to the president even before he addressed the Congress on Iran and allied himself with the Republicans. Even in the Oval Office, many times he will put his finger up, and I have seen him in the Oval Office telling the president, you have to understand the Jewish history, and, you know, talking about how the Jews has been prosecuted. So yes, he's the way he comes across, definitely, as if he's, dictating the policies to the president of the United States. And the White House has been weak. I have to say that even when he came and addressed Congress, they said they don't want to see him because it was an election campaign. She should have said that they have not coordinated with the White House. I mean, it's outrageous that a foreign leader can come without consulting with the President of the United States or the White House and go straight to address a joint session of Congress.
Well, I question how much responsibility John Boehner and the Congress had on that. Nadia, and the White House was in a very awkward position. They talked about how outrageous it was. I don't know what else they could have done, David.
You can't stop a foreign leader from coming. You can't stop him from addressing Congress, and Congress did the invitation here.
Right.
And, you know, to some degree, I think the White House ended up, I think it's fair to say, probably on top of this whole dispute. I think that the speech, then the letter that was drafted by Tom Cotton and signed by 47 Republicans, I think to some degree somewhat blew up on them. I suspect that, you know, what you'll now see is the Democrats are, who ordinarily might join some of these resolutions against the Iranian nuclear deal, are going to be more reluctant to.
Shane, let me ask you about the horror going on currently in Yemen.
Yeah, well, this is breaking news out of Yemen this morning. We're getting word of multiple suicide bombings. Last we checked, at least 137 people killed, 345 reported wounded. These were at two mosques, the Al-Badr and the Al-Hashush Mosque, which are both Shiite mosques. Initial fingerprints on this would look to be like Al-Qaeda, right? This is a multiple bombings, coordinated. We have reports of one bombing in the mosque. When people fled, there was another suicide bomber waiting for them. We've seen these kinds of vicious attacks before. And if this is Al-Qaeda, why would they want to be doing it? I mean, they are clearly trying to exploit what is already, I think, probably fair to say, a civil war, if you want to at least call it on the verge of that, to gain a foot more of a foothold and consolidate their power there. Importantly, Al-Qaeda in Yemen is the group that U.S. counterterrorism officials have historically been the most worried about for their ability to build bombs that can be smuggled onto airplanes and avoid security detection. So if this is Al-Qaeda doing this devastating attack, it would single, you know, another escalation there as well. And there probably will be more dead as the day goes on, based on what we've heard.
And Yemen is a failed state. I mean, funny enough, President Obama cited it as a success model, I think, last September, saying that we can target Al-Qaeda there using drones, and we have the security agreement with the government of Yemen. But since the Houthis, which is a Shiite rebel that aligned with Iran and supported and funded by Iran, took over, and they forced President Hadi, which is the president who has been democratically elected, into a house arrest for weeks until he managed to escape. And now he is in a palace in the port city of Aden. The country has descended in a complete, really nothing to describe it, but a civil war. It's back to the 90s, where the North and the South are split from each other. And now you have the Iranians basically supporting this Houthi rebels with, funny enough, another an ally or former ally of the administration, which is President Ali Abdullah Saleh himself, who is the administration has invested in him. But he's in cahoot with the Houthis, the Shiite rebels now, and he's mounting this attacks on, actually, in addition to what Shane just talked about, the attacks on the mosque, which is, has, as I agree, the modus operandi of Al-Qaeda there, and the suicide bombing and multiple attacks as well on Shiite targets on a Friday, which killed, by the way, a very well-known Shiite cleric there today. It also, they're trying to attack the palace where President Hadi is in, and they're also mounting another attack on Taz and on Saada. So it's really descending on way beyond what we expect from Yemen. It's even worse than expectation.
All right, let's go now to Johnny in Brandywine, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, Ms. Diane. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
I am so angry and disgusted with the Prime Minister of Israel. And I hope he remembers that the United States demographic is changing. The sweet support that Israel is enjoying and blind support that we don't question whatever they do. We're disrespecting President Obama like this. As an African-American, I will remember it. And a lot of people are remembering that the Democrats, that he's not going to be able to come to America and ask for stuff, and he might be finding opposition. And it's not because he's anti-Semitic. Is because, you know, Israel is not another state of the United States. They're not, Washington, D.C. don't even have the right that Israel has. And he comes in, you know, just disrespecting us, like, and we just accept it. I don't understand it.
Well, again, you can't confuse the relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu with the broader relationship between the United States and Israel. And Israel was obviously born out of the greatest tragedies of World War II, recognized by Harry Truman over the objections of many in his government, including his Secretary of State at the time. And I think it's very possible to maintain the strategic and cultural relationship and still have differences with Prime Minister Netanyahu over policy. And the best way to deal with both Palestinian issues and with Iran. And, you know, we've got a lot of allies with whom over the years we have had some pretty sharp differences. The British, the French, and the Germans just went and signed up with the Chinese on a development bank that is basically meant to undercut the World Bank. It went completely.
And why did they do that?
Well, they did this largely because the way they view the issue is a form of bolstering their own exports to China. and a belief that the Chinese were not going to play in a Western-dominated system.
And could this bank pose a threat to the power of the World Bank and the IMF?
More to the World Bank than the IMF. The IMF handles financial crises. This bank is intended as it's called the China Infrastructure Bank. The fear is that China will use it to fund its pet projects and to do it under a set of rules that it sets rather than the rules that were set by the West and expressed through the World Bank. But let's face it, the president of the World Bank is always appointed by Washington, and the Chinese were saying it's time for that to end.
Shame.
Yeah, and I think that this is something to be expected in a way, too. I mean, there have been movements afoot to try and change the governance structure of the IMF as well, which the Americans tend to dominate, and a lot of this has been being blocked by Republicans in Congress. I mean, at some point, the Chinese are not going to have to take this anymore, right? They're a growing world economic superpower. They have ambitions of being a first world power. It makes, you know, in many ways, complete sense that they would do this, and we could see it coming. You know, the protestations from the administration are, as David said, well, this bank might be using the same standards as we would, and what about their lending practices? But our allies are joining it. The Australians today said they're probably going to join
it
on Monday.
And the South Koreans.
And, you know, the administration did not handle this one terribly well.
Right.
You didn't hear the president out in public making a case. You saw them somewhat blindsided by it. Secretary John Kerry met his German counterpart a week ago and made the case in private. The Germans went off in their own direction anyway. And the White House has not had a terribly cogent argument to make in response. Mm.
Interesting. All right, let's go now to Patrick in Austin. No, it's Richard in Haverhill, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Diane. In addition to what the panel said about Netanyahu using, you know, racism, nationalism, and fear, the foreign secretary, Lieberman, also said that any Palestinian, Israeli Palestinian, is not loyal to Israel. They should be beheaded. But what I want to say, though, Diane, is we give $3 billion a year to Israel, and I think we, with the international community, should have a boycott, divestiture, and sanctions like we did with South Africa and that ended apartheid. Also, David, the Palestinians had nothing to do with the horror of the Holocaust, but they're paying the penalty for that. It's for the Palestinians at all.
All right. Thanks for your call, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Any chance that the U.S. might cut back on aid to Israel?
No, I don't think so.
I don't see any chance of that, and I'm not even sure that one would want to confuse what's going on with the policy differences with the prime minister with the underlying question of aid to Israel, because you don't do the aid to Israel just to help Israel. You do a lot of the aid to Israel to help American strategy in the Middle East.
Yeah, but the previous administration, as you know, like Jim Baker during the Bush 1 rule, he was really angry with Prime Minister Shamir at the time. And he said, if you're serious about the peace process, call me, and this is my number. And also they threatened about the settlements that they will hold aid. At least they give the perception that they will hold it. And this administration can do that. I don't see it happening now. But as I said, they have all the cards to play now, especially at the UN and withholding aid.
I mean, we tend to take for granted the strength of the intelligence and the military and the security alliance between Israel and the United States, and there's good reason for that. But I was in Israel for a week in December, just after Netanyahu had called for the new elections. And just this is anecdotal, but one of the things that so impressed me was in my conversations with people, the degree to which they were deeply concerned that they were losing broad bases of support that they had traditionally enjoyed in the United States, the degree to which they felt that the American press was against them. This is particularly after the Gaza war. So there was, even among ordinary Israelis who I talked to, sort of a worry about, is there a degree to to which this relationship gets strained so much that it does start to fracture in ways that we had never anticipated or could not have imagined.
And more than that, the Israeli press itself, like Haaretz, for example, very respected newspaper, they were saying that this is a win for Netanyahu and a loss for Israel. Because as a result, for example, if he continues with this idea that he dismisses the two-state solution, you know, look at Europe, not just the United States, because they will support them no matter what. But Europe is the one of the top trade partner with Israel, and they might start putting restriction. The idea of Israel being isolated, the idea that Israeli leaders might be not allowed to travel to Europe because of the ICC. So there's so many things that it could be similar to what we have seen in South Africa.
And finally, what do we know about the death threats made against Caroline Kennedy, the U.S. ambassador to Japan?
There was an arrest for somebody who put out threats in general to the embassies. It's not clear whether that person was responsible for the death threats to Caroline Kennedy herself. She seems to be settling into her job as ambassador. She showed up in person even after these threats were over. I was there last week and saw her briefly, and I would have to say that the biggest concern, I think, for safety came because of the attack on Mark Lippert, the ambassador, the American ambassador in Korea.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. David Sanger, Nadia Bill Basie, Shane Harris, have a great weekend, everybody.
You too,
Dan.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.